The Science of Polaris Dawn and Water Under Mars. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Burr. SpaceX's Polaris Dawn mission is launching this week from Kennedy Space Center with an all-civilian crew of four on a five-day mission into space. And on that mission, scientists are studying how spaceflight affects the human body. We'll speak with Translational Research Institute for Space Health's Jimmy Wu about how they will monitor the crew and help further research of the human body on both Earth and in orbit. Then, Mars has a secret under its surface. Has water been locked up deep within Mars, changing what scientists have previously thought about the Martian landscape? We'll speak with University of Florida astrobiologist Amy Williams about that question and the scientific discoveries on the Red Planet. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? SpaceX's Polaris Dawn mission is launching this week, sending a civilian crew of four into space, where they will perform the first commercial spacewalk. And this crew will also help scientists understand how space travel affects the human body. The Translational Research Institute for Space Health, or TRISH, at Baylor College of Medicine is trying to help better understand that. The research will study how the environment of space impacts things from vision and bodily fluids to motion sickness and radiation. Here to talk more about the experiments and how this will advance health science both in space and here on Earth is Jimmy Wu, the Deputy Director and Chief Engineer at TRISH. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we've had your colleagues from TRISH on this show ahead of these civilian space missions, and the research you're getting is extremely exciting. But this is a particularly interesting mission, right? Tell me a bit about some of the research questions that are guiding you and your colleagues as Polaris Dawn kind of heads higher than any other orbital vehicle has before.
That is new in the sense that the altitude this mission will go on since the Apollo era, since the Apollo missions. And so we don't have a whole lot of data of human exposure at that extreme of an environment. So it's nice to get more of that. It's nice to see commercial spaceflight taking the risk and opportunity to do things that we haven't done before. So those are all very exciting things, and we just want to make sure that we're there to collect the data on these pioneers so that we can build upon that as the next set of missions come forward.
TRISH is collecting quite a bit of data through a bunch of different experiments. Is there a particular one that you're extremely excited about that you would want to chat a little bit about?
I mean, this is like asking who your favorite child is.
I know. It'd take the whole show for us to go over all these experiments.
Right. No, there's quite a few of them that are unique and exciting in their own way. We have, you know, ultrasound guidance, we have cognitive, we have sensory motor. Probably the richest potential data set is probably the Space Omics Protocol, looking at the omic profile of these participants, of these flyers. And so that potentially has a wealth of data, especially as medicine on Earth is starting to transition to more personalized precision medicine, where we can get a lot more details about our own individual health, and it could be personalized to our specific needs versus a current health model where it's a bit more generic, one size fits all type medicine. So this could be, the medical field is already starting to transition, but I think something like this using spaceflight to help further show the value of this type of approach to medicine could just, one, make it more mainstream and understandable to the general public, but two, I think helps provide more ability for individuals to make smarter decisions about their health care, and to have it be bespoke and personalized could be that part that brings healthcare quality down and healthcare costs down as well.
What was the acronym you used there? OMEC?
Well, it's not an acronym. It's OMICS. It's the general field of like genomics, proteomics.
Gotcha.
Right. So it's the suffix part of it. It's just the general field of analyzing your body at the subcellular level.
Let's talk a bit about that collection, right? I mean, because the first all-civilian mission was Inspiration 4. Since then, there have been other private missions that have gone to the International Space Station and back. And now we have this one, which is the first of three for Jared Isaacman and his Polaris program. This has got to be a research scientist's greatest gift, right? To be able to have all of this data coming back and coming back to relatively quickly, right?
Yeah, we see it as a tremendous opportunity, right? That's why, you know, we're excited here at Trish to be able to be the one of the leading organizations to support, facilitate the science for these missions. Tremendous opportunity. You know, we think we've shown that the platform, commercial spaceflight, is a viable platform for high quality human research. And so we want to continue to leverage it and use it for those purposes, and not just show that here is a baseline type of capability that can be done. Here's what you can potentially do with it across the board, given the participants who are going and the nature of the mission. I think it's important to understand the potential and then be the pioneers, the initial folks to be able to try to work in that environment and then learn from it to see how much more can be done on those platforms. And so it's really, really a blessing with Jerry Eisenman and his program. They see science as a value to their mission, and that they would allow us to be able to bring in such a great portfolio of science.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was this an easy sell for Jared and the rest of his team? They obviously understand the purpose of scientific discovery, but you didn't have to twist their arm or anything for this, did you?
No, not necessarily. And I mean, we saw that obviously with Inspiration 4, getting to meet Jer and that team, their willingness to participate. And it's obviously carried over into the Polaris program as well. So it wasn't challenging to have him understand and communicate the value of science. Because of that support, we want to do the best things, best quality work that we can do on our end to be able to best take advantage of, you know, while scarce now in terms of humans going into space, so obviously this is the stepping stone of more and more people going to space, but you could make an argument that because it is humans going to space is rate limiting, that you do have to take the best advantage of the opportunities that do present themselves. And so the fact Jared and his team is already so willing, we have to make sure that we're not squandering that opportunity.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Jimmy Wu, the Deputy Director and Chief Engineer at the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, about the organization's research that will be conducted with the crew of SpaceX's Polaris Dawn. I know with Inspiration 4, Haley, one of the mission participants, was a physician assistant. Do you have to worry about giving the participants some sort of additional training to collect this data? And how do you go about doing that? I've got to assume collecting samples would not be very easy if you didn't have the training or also in the microgravity environment of space travel. So what goes into training them for this?
There's actually elements of research involved with the human performance side of training, right? Because you're right, it's not as simple as here's a widget, it's an easy button widget, just do this, do that, and you're done, right? There is that. Access to crew for training before the mission is critical. We understood that with commercial spaceflight. You know, these are not professional astronauts. They have a regular day job, and then they, in their extra time, discretionary time, they're able to do this extra training to be able to support a mission like this. So we had to recognize that the burden of time for training was also a scarce resource. And so we do want to advocate for research that is relatively easy to use, minimizes the training that is required, that enables for more science potentially. And I think that the real benefit is going to be for those of us on Earth is having hardware and capabilities that are designed for ease of use, so that in some ways you can see in the long run how this could be accessible to the general population, where you don't need to go to a specialist to get a particular procedure done. Worry about, like, when can this doctor see me in 6 months or 9 months? Like, if it's easy to use, can it be done at home? You know, can it be sort of democratized and decentralized so that there's more health equity for everyone to be able to access information about themselves or some treatments so that they can, you know, live the best lives that they can.
So yeah, so just to recap, you're saying that the technology that you use to help collect these samples, these bodily fluids, the blood and all that stuff from these astronauts could be used in the future for technology down here for someone like you and me who, you know, we're not in space, right? We could be able to test on ourselves.
Yeah, and it's not just necessarily just a collection of biosamples, right? It's just general collection of health and performance. You know, can we have a device that collects your heart rate a little easier, that collects, you know, blood samples a little easier, that collects, you know, that does an assessment of of your cognitive behavior, right? Like if you, your kid bumped his head and you're worried about it, are you able to kind of do a quick test to make sure that there isn't anything more severe? Like we obviously have heard the cases of people with traumatic head injuries, they seem fine. And then days, hours later, their health degrades dramatically. So yeah, it would be tools like that to be able to do those kind of assessments quickly and accurately. And so we look at technology to help drive that optimization of time as well.
When I think about how many of these missions we've had, I believe this will be the fifth private mission SpaceX is flying. It doesn't seem like a lot, but when you think Inspiration 4 happened in 2022, I believe, like the amount, your sample size is growing at an exponential rate thanks to these private commercial missions. This data set, where is it going? Who is using it? And just how quickly do you think that it will grow to get data that can be applied to both on space and down here on Earth?
The first one regarding where the data is going. So here at Trish, our program that is supporting this research is the acronym is called EXPAND. So we actually have a database that does house all this data. Mentioned a little earlier, we are hoping at some point to actually release this to the scientific community. So researchers with legitimate scientific inquiries with merit review on their proposals will have an opportunity to request the data and may have it released to them as long as we can maintain the confidentiality of the subjects, right? And so we are setting up a mechanism and a process for that. We'll talk about that more once we're ready to open for business on that end. So that answers the first part. Your second question is, at what point is there enough data to be able to have enough significance that the finding we have is consistent? That's difficult because normally on Earth, you know, if you do the power analysis, you know, the clinical trial studies that we expect, like the FDA does for clearing a pharmaceutical agent or something like that, those are typically in the orders of like tens of thousands of subjects, right? So we're obviously going to be a while before we do that spaceflight. And so in spaceflight, we often have to deal with low-end statistical analysis, which has been like this for all of human history. Like if you just even count the number of souls that have been in space, it's still under 700 total. It goes to show how much more we have to go. And to your point about hopefully this exponential curve of humans going to space, yeah, we're hoping that happens, but it's hard to know until these companies are doing this at a more frequent cadence. And if there are other providers out there, we're kind of focusing on orbital missions, but the suborbital folks with the Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic have, I've been taking people to space at a far greater clip, even though they're getting much shorter exposures, right? A short 5-minute parabola versus a, multi-day stay in space. So there are distinctions there between the nature of the types of missions and the potential science that can be done with them. So I think it remains to be seen. And then I think the biggest part too is not even just the number of people going to space, but the type of, is the research that's being made available to each participant, is it standardized across the board? So that's the hope that we have here with Trish and the EXPAND program, is a standardized protocol that can be used mission to mission so that eventually those data sets can be pooled.
Well, Jimmy, if you need a volunteer, I'm happy to increase your sample size by one. I don't have a ride up there yet, but once I do, I'll let you know. Jimmy Wu, thank you so much for chatting with us. And again, congrats on all of the research you've been able to accomplish with Trish.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was Jimmy Wu, the Deputy Director and Chief Engineer at the Translational Research Institute for Space Health. Still to come, what's going on the red planet?
It doesn't say we found life. It means that we found something that is so intriguing and that sometimes life on Earth makes it. So we need to further study this rock.
Big discoveries on Mars with water and rocks. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Could Mars be more similar to Earth than we thought? While NASA's InSight mission is retired, the robot's data is still being studied, and from it, scientists have discovered that there could be water underneath Mars. And in other rover news, Perseverance has found rocks on Mars with a very interesting finding that raises the question, could life exist on Mars? Well, here to talk about these two discoveries is Amy Williams. She's a member of the rover's science teams and astrobiologist at the University of Florida. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for the invitation.
So, Amy, we normally talk about findings from our friends Perseverance and Curiosity, but InSight had a pretty phenomenal finding. Tell us a bit about the data that InSight found and the possibility of there being, what is it, water all underneath the surface of Mars?
Yeah, water is the mystery that keeps on giving on Mars. And I think this is a really good way to point out that even a mission that has concluded, like InSight, is still giving us extraordinary data. So yeah, InSight data was used and published recently. The interpretation is that in the subsurface, very, very deep underground, there is liquid water. And so this isn't, don't think of it as like an underground lake. This is something that we would consider groundwater. So it is water that is within the pores and cracks of a rock. So you can't swim in it, but it appears to be quite a lot of water based on the modeling that's been done to understand sort of what InSight was able to see into the deep subsurface of Mars.
So then what is the significance of this finding? If it's not this giant ocean of water that you and I could swim in, or you know, there could be this slim chance that there are microbes in there, why is this so fascinating to scientists like yourself that there is signatures of water within the rocks under the surface of Mars?
Well, we know that there's evidence for water on the surface of Mars in the past, and there's little whiffs of it here and there as far as water ice and potentially really briny water that we see in the near surface. But this is extraordinary because this is a massive volume of water in the very deep subsurface. You know, one of the questions that we still have is about Mars is, where did the water go? Was it lost to space? Was it locked up in minerals in the subsurface? You know, this is now another potential explanation for much of the water that we know was on the surface of Mars in the ancient past, and that perhaps it's now trapped in the deep subsurface, miles below the surface. And the fact that it's in liquid form is of course really exciting for the astrobiology potential for habitable environments in the deep subsurface.
Last time you were on the show, we talked about following the water, and that is exactly what this is. It followed where the water went.
That's exactly right.
I want to talk a bit about how this data came to be. InSight, to my knowledge, that was looking at seismic activity on the planet, right? How did it find water if it was looking for Mars quakes?
This can be my plug for all those people who say, what do geologists even do? I'm a geologist. And even though I don't do this particular subset of geology, it is something that is used abundantly on Earth, of course, to understand earthquakes and seismicity and human hazards. But we employed a similar kind of technique, a seismograph on the surface of Mars. And we can look for Mars quakes with that seismograph. But one of the other things that you can do is actually tell something about what is in the subsurface of Mars by how basically the Mars quakes move through the subsurface. So the seismic waves move in different ways when they move through different materials. So you'll get a signal that's a little bit different if it's passing through solid rock, if it's passing through rock with water ice in it, or rock that has liquid water and pore spaces. And so not only can we tell a lot more about the interior of Mars all the way down to the core, but we can actually refine detail about what is in the crust, and that can be kind of a miles deep crust in this case, where we see liquid water in those pore spaces.
This is really, really neat. And is InSight still collecting data, or is this just scientists caching through an abundance of data that mission collected?
That mission has now concluded, and InSight is a very expensive paperweight now on Mars, unfortunately. But again, this does speak to the longevity of the data that come back from missions that are not still active. So there are actually programs at NASA that are meant to fund researchers to go through the old data, because there is so much data and there's so much you can look back on, you can reinterpret, use new tools. And in this case, these data were used in a type of like rock physics model that can kind of tell you about the materials the rocks are made of, if there's anything in pore spaces. And so that's how these conclusions were reached, by feeding these data into a model that's built for Earth, But it turns out we can actually apply those techniques to understanding the interior of other planets as well.
Fascinating stuff. Well, let's go from paperweight to robotic explorer and talk about Percy, because it seems like, Amy, every time you come on the show, you're like, oh, I've got this cool finding about this new rock we found. Percy has found, again, another cool rock, and I think this one's cooler than before, right? Tell us a bit about what it found.
In the past couple of weeks, we put out a statement and declared that we found this really intriguing rock. It has a couple of features in it that have actually led the mission to label it as something called a potential biosignature. Now, this does not mean evidence of life. And as, you know, your resident astrobiologist, I just want to make it clear that it doesn't say we found life. It means that we found something that is so intriguing and that sometimes life on Earth makes it. So we need to further study this rock in order to understand why it has basically the geology and the chemistry that it has. So all of that, you know, NASA speak to say that this really cool rock has signatures in it detected with our Sherlock Raman instrument that's consistent with organic carbon. And if you've listened to me on the show before, you know that organic carbon can be made by life, but it can also be made plenty of ways that don't require life. And in concert with that is actually this really neat sort of reduction texture in the rock that we see. And so the texture is something that is often associated with basically microbial organisms, things like our bacteria on Earth, kind of interacting with the rock and organic carbon in order to create these types of reduction features in the rock.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Amy Williams, a member of the Mars Rover's science teams and an astrobiologist at the University of Florida, about recent findings on water and Martian rocks that are very similar to some found here on Earth.
That's still extremely exciting, the fact that even if it's the slimmest of possibility that this could be formed by some sort of life, what is the next step? Because I also know, Amy, with you being on the show, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. How are you going to further investigate this rock to answer those questions?
This is the kind of thing that this mission was set up to do, was to find intriguing rocks like this. And the way to assess, whether you can move from a potential biosignature to a definitive biosignature is by returning that rock to Earth as part of our sample suite from our sample return, and using a suite of techniques to interrogate whether the organic carbon is made by life or is made geologically, whether those features, those little halos I described, have any evidence for microbial mediation. It would take multiple lines of evidence for the astrobiology community to come to consensus on whether something was made by life that we found on Mars. And so this rock is no different. We would need to, use every technique available to us to try to come to a conclusion about that. But it is very exciting to be exploring Mars and making really cool discoveries all the time, but then to find something that is the kind of rock we've been hoping to run across, something that has a hint about an interesting environment in the deep past and the potential for life on Mars.
Amy, I know you said this is the type of rock that you are looking to find. Was this the first that got this potential moniker? And how many more of these do you hope to find or expect to find as Percy continues its mission?
So this is the first sample that we have made a statement about it fulfilling the criteria for a potential biosignature. But there are tons of rocks in the cache that answer a huge variety of questions. And there are certainly rocks in the cache that have caught our attention as the types of rocks where you might be able to look for evidence of life. It's sort of like, instead of us knocking on the rocks and saying, hey, is anyone home? This rock was the one that was like, hey, I'm really special. Come look at me. By using our cameras and looking around at interesting textures and features, that we were able to identify this as something so important. We were able to study it a little bit more and collect a core. So it's really just this kind of like back and forth of, oh, that's interesting. Oh, these are really interesting little dots in here. What are these made of? Let's get into this more. And then eventually, we made the decision to sample at this really, really intriguing location.
With this being the first to receive this designation, can you tell me how excited you and the team were to make this discovery? As you said, this is what this mission set out to find. and you found it.
So searching for biosignatures is certainly one of the major pillars of this mission. And so finding something that we can put the designation of a potential biosignature on it is extremely exciting. We have to be very careful in taking this any further and saying that you have found a biosignature. And that's why we have the potential in front of that term, because, you know, there's so much that we can study on Earth with this, and there's so many ways for us to explore whether this is really a biosignature. And we need to do our due diligence to feel confident whatever, you know, answer we come to. But as an astrobiologist and someone who's just really interested in whether there's life beyond Earth, to find something like this is a really exciting finding. And I deeply hope we get these samples back one day so that we can try to actually, you know, close the book on this and to understand whether we did find evidence for life on Mars.
As someone who speaks to an astrobiologist quite regularly, I am also just as excited. So thank you.
Fantastic.
Finally, Amy, I always like to close out our conversations with what's ahead on Mars. And before we started recording, you said there's a dust storm ahead. What is that? And how are you preparing our robotic friends for what might come?
Yeah, there's a really repeatable regional dust storm that normally comes up around this time of year on Mars. And so it looks like that's starting to kick up again, as we would expect. The really cool thing about the missions is that we're able to monitor how dust storms evolve and, you know, reach the different areas that we're exploring in Jezero and in Gale Crater. So we are able to kind of increase the cadence at which we monitor the atmosphere. You can actually see the sky get darker with dust. The opacity, you know, increases. You're not able to see as far, and so it's this really kind of neat seasonal feature that we see. And so, you know, this isn't, at least yet, a global dust storm. I don't know if it would become one, but it's one of those major regional storms we watch for. And so, seeing it kind of kick up on the order of days is really cool. So it's just a reminder that Mars is not a long dead planet. It is still a very active and dynamic world.
And will Percy be okay? That's really what I'm concerned about.
Oh yeah. So the dust is just like a little you know, smattering on the back of the rovers. But the dust is just something that we kind of cruise through and continue on our way, sort of like living in Florida in the summer during a rainstorm. You can pull out your umbrella and you carry on.
Well, that's good to know. So Percy, hang on. You've got many more rocks to find. We've been speaking with Amy Williams. She's an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a scientist on NASA's Mars rovers. Amy, thanks so much for the updates.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, even on YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AEWTY Space. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage online, visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.